the winds are lighter. High on the day here of 11. I wish you a very peaceful night. Good night.
Thank you to you too. Now, our book of the week. In 1997, Margaret Thatcher invited Charles Moore to write her biography on the understanding that it would not be published until after her death. During his research, he uncovered a cache of letters written by Margaret to her sister Muriel, which give revealing insights into her private life. In this first extract, it's 1941, and the 15-year-old Margaret has just sat her school certificate. Nicholas Farrell reads from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography.
In Margaret Roberts' earliest known letter, of which only one sheet survives, she analysed her exams. The biggest problem was presented by geography. The first paper, based on work with the Ordnance Survey map, was not too bad. But the other paper, on the British Isles and one continent, was very disappointing. For one continent we did America, and the questions on it were not at all bad. But out of the three on the British Isles, there was only one we could touch. All of them involved a fairly detailed knowledge of Scotland and Ireland. Unfortunately, we had not touched Ireland and had had precisely two lessons on Scotland. However, we managed to survive it. Even at the age of 15, the map of her future political sympathies is laid out. England and America understood, Scotland little studied, Ireland terra incognita, and continental Europe not even mentioned. In the event, Margaret need not have worried. She got a credit in geography. In her second letter, written to her sister Muriel on the 20th of September 1941, she tabulates her full results. She got distinctions in chemistry, arithmetic, and algebra, and credits in all other subjects, with the exception of life drawing, in which she managed only a lowly pass. Margaret goes on to share her thoughts about the future with her sister. When going into sixth lower, you need not necessarily decide what career you're going to take up. Daddy does not like the idea of medical at all, but I am taking biology, chemistry, and maths main with French subsid. The next idea on the list is to go to university and take a science degree, then sit for a civil service exam for posts abroad. A degree is necessary for this for a woman. Although all her contemporaries attest to a seriousness in Margaret, which made her different from the others, she took part in all the normal interests and activities of a teenage girl of that period. She enjoyed tennis and played hockey well enough to be in the school team. More striking and more apparently at odds with her upbringing was a strong interest in glamour, both in films and in fashion. Lorna Smith, who came into the school in September 1941, remembered her as quiet, hard-working, poised, calm and self-confident. Some people found her slightly irritating, and even rather conceited, but I fear there was an element of envy there. What marked Margaret out, though, was her sense of purpose. As Shirley Ellis put it, she always stood out because teenage girls don't know where they're going. She did. Her first public performances were recitations, and she favoured such poetry, well-known passages of Longfellow, Tennyson, Whitman or Kipling, as made its moral meaning plain and expressed it with grandeur and force. It was partly for these exercises that she began the first of several stints of elocution lessons, which were to punctuate her career. According to Connie Pitchford, a contemporary at Kesteven and Grantham Girls' School, Margaret suffered from a slight lisp and had trouble pronouncing her R's. In 1936, she and Connie had elocution lessons together. Later, her carefully modulated tones used to irritate many of her contemporaries at Somerville, Oxford, who considered them artificial. So, in a sense, they were. But the purpose of the artifice was more purity of diction than climbing up the greasy political or social pole. To her first serious boyfriend, she gave a copy of Palgrave's Golden Treasury. To the man whom, before Dennis, she most nearly married,
She sent the complete works of Shakespeare. Neither choice shows any originality of literary taste, but her reverence and affection for great writing were genuine. She extended these feelings above all to the authorized version of the Bible, singling out Isaiah, the Gospels, and the Acts of the Apostles. Her choice of Acts is slightly unusual and worth noting. It is the most important book in the Scriptures about the propagation of a message to the world. And to the end of her life, she retained the words of scores of the classic English hymns in her mind. At Dennis's funeral in July 2003, when her anguish and mental confusion were such that she was not sure whether it was her husband's or her father's coffin in front of her, she was seen to sing all the hymns, word perfect, without looking at the service sheet. In the spring of 1943, the post-exam celebrations resulted in ink being spilt on the precious parquet floor of our form room. For Lorna Smith, this was a second offence. She recalled, knowing that soap and water was useless, what was to be done? Surely this time we would be expelled. Then someone thought of our star scientist. Margaret Roberts would know what would remove the now spreading black stain. Her remedy was that it should be sprinkled with bleaching powder and then have hydrochloric acid poured on, stolen from the lab. I scrubbed away furiously, and sure enough, the boards began to recover. But the next moment, I was almost overcome by the fumes. No one knew that the lethal mixture would give off chlorine gas. The staff were too generally concerned about us to be angry at the mess. I suspect that Margaret had owned up to her near-fatal advice. Once in the sixth form, Margaret became a prefect, and she seems to have taken to her duties with the energy, dedication, and slight exasperation at the weaknesses of others which were to mark her later career. In 1942, according to her sister Muriel, Margaret told the head, Miss Gillies, that she wanted to go to Oxford, and Miss Gillies said, "I'm afraid you can't. You haven't got Latin." Margaret said, "I'll get it." And so she went to the Latin master of the boys' school, and she got a Latin in a year, and she got in. Margaret was apprehensive about Oxford. The only people she knew there were Mary Wallace and Margaret Goodrich, neither of whom was at her college, Somerville, and both of whom came from a more educated social background. She consulted them. Mary Wallace received Margaret in her parents' house in September 1943, where she found her very earnest. She remembered she was very keen to do the right thing, and as so often in her later career, expressed this in an anxiety about what sort of clothes to wear. Margaret Goodrich recorded that when she first visited Margaret in Somerville, they found her lonely and disconsolate, toasting a tea cake by a fire that was rationed to one scuttle of coal per week. Margaret herself admitted that she felt shy and ill at ease. One of Margaret's problems was money. Without a scholarship, she had to depend on what her father could manage and on what various small college bursaries could provide. Rachel Willink, one of the only two women before Margaret to become president of AUCA, the Oxford University Conservative Association, remembered her as quiet, rather mousy, someone who hadn't got the style to make up for her background. In after years, she said people who had known Margaret at Oxford found it a thing out of nature that that rather humourless mouse had been so astonishingly successful. No letters from Margaret survive from her first year at Oxford. But in the fairly numerous ones she wrote, almost all to Muriel, in her next 3 years, clothes and the difficulty of affording them provide the main subject. On her first ever visit to Bond Street, she found a fairly plain little frock with a Peter Pan collar, two little pockets on the bodice, and two to match on the skirt for £3.16. Even this price was high for Margaret. But the elderly assistant then did a hard sell. She saw that I was a little surprised, and said that it was superb value for money. Always the way to Margaret's heart. The bargain hunter was persuaded, as she excitedly recounts. Well, to cut a long story short, I bought the frock, and I'm sure that it is one of the most worthwhile purchases I've ever made. In hall at Somerville, Margaret sat with the grammar school products. It was natural to them to accommodate Margaret, and they did so, but without great enthusiasm. Part of Margaret's relative isolation at Somerville derives from the fact that she was a scientist. As a chemist, she was one of only 5 women in her year in the entire university. Long hours in the labs and lectures, which, unlike those in the arts, were more or less compulsory, kept her away from much of the society of her fellow Somervillians. Although she worked hard, Margaret did not particularly enjoy life in the lab. "I was much more interested in the theory than in the practical work." Although the war provided the subject of constant and consuming interest for undergraduate conversation, it had the curious effect of making Oxford less actively political. This absence of political controversy characterizes Margaret's correspondence with her sister. It is striking that Margaret's letters contain scarcely a single expression of political views. The end of the war in Europe in May 1945 and the general election in July hardened politics up. Margaret took part in the campaign, mostly in Grantham rather than Oxford, since it was held on the 5th of July. She went to the picture house to watch the results come through on the screen. They shocked her. 60 years later, Margaret said that the loss of Winston Churchill was really quite shattering. The Oxford to which she returned in October 1945 was changed in atmosphere. By the atom bombs and subsequent Allied victory in the Far East, by the Labour election victory, and by the return or first arrival of undergraduates who had fought. By this time an officer in the Oxford University Conservative Association, she joined its policy subcommittee and co-wrote a report. Here there are notes to be found of what later became the Thatcher tunes. "The individual is more important than the system. Individual enterprise is the mainspring of all progress." The toughest comments refer to the Conservative Party itself. "A reorientation of conservatism within the framework of the 20th century state will be necessary if the party is to avoid annihilation." In October 1946, Margaret went for the first time as a representative to the party conference in Blackpool. By the standards of Tory conferences at that time, the mood from the floor was rebellious. The rank and file attacked the leadership for not putting forward clear Tory policies and beliefs. She was, she wrote, "entranced." This is perhaps the only recorded occasion when anyone has used that word about a Conservative conference. And yet it is probably an apt one in Margaret's case. She identified with the feelings of the body of the Tory hall and felt liberated and uplifted by them. Such identification would one day help make her leadership so secure for so long when more senior figures in the party hoped to undermine her. In 1946, those senior figures felt a little beleaguered. "I had the sense," wrote Margaret, "that the party leadership, with the notable exception of Churchill, had arrived at Blackpool prepared to reconcile itself and conservatism to the permanence of socialism in Britain." This was decidedly not what the rank and file wanted to hear. My instincts were with the rank and file.
Nicholas Farrell continues to read from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography by Charles Moore. At the same time tomorrow, the abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer, Elizabeth Allard. Now to take us to the shipping forecast, a little of Sailing By.
Thank you.
And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 30th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Fisher, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, 300 miles southwest of Iceland, 1015. Expected southeast Iceland, 1002, by 1800 Tuesday. New high, expected Humber, 1028, by same time. Low, southern Norway, 995, moving away northeastwards. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, northwest backing southwest, 6 to gale 8, showers, good. North Utsira, South Utsira, northwesterly 6 to gale 8, becoming variable 4, showers, good. Forties, northwest 6 to gale 8, backing south 5 to 7, fair, good. Cromarty, 4th Tyne, West Dogger, northwesterly backing southerly 5 to 7, fair, good. East Dogger, southwest Fisher, westerly veering northwesterly 5 to 7, becoming variable 4 later. Fair, good. Northeast Fisher, southwesterly veering northwesterly 6 to gale 8, decreasing 5 or 6 later. Fair, good. German Bight, North Humber, southwesterly veering northwesterly.